Our next case this morning is number 043073, Richard Disher against Citigroup Global. Mr. Eamon.
May it please the court, I'm Walter Riemann. I represent defendant appellant Solomon Smith Barney. This appeal concerns whether the Securities Litigation Uniform Standards Act, or SLUSA, preempts a putative class action purportedly brought on behalf of certain SSB customers. The appeal also involves questions relating to the district court's diversity jurisdiction, federal question jurisdiction, and related to bankruptcy jurisdiction. Plaintiff filed the underlying putative nationwide class action in state court in Madison County, although Madison County has no greater connection to the events underlying the lawsuit than any place else in the country. The putative class consists of SSB clients who held unspecified internet and telecom stocks in their SSB accounts at times when the prices of those stocks were in decline and when SSB was issuing allegedly unjustified favorable ratings on the stocks. In substance, the complaint alleges that SSB issued false positive analyst reports containing positive recommendations in which SSB did not believe for the purpose of obtaining investment banking business. Putative class members supposedly held those stocks in reliance on the false reports. SSB removed to the district court. The district court granted a motion to remand. SSB appeals from the remand order under the authority of this court's Kircher decision. Let me, if I may, address the SLUSA issues first. SLUSA preempts state law covered class actions that allege a misrepresentation or omission in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. It is undisputed that all requirements for SLUSA preemption are met here with one exception. Plaintiffs and SSB disagree as to whether the in connection with requirement is met. The complaint contains a general disavowal of claims based on the purchase or sale of securities, although, as I'll explain later, it doesn't effectuate that disavowal in the actual class definition. But plaintiffs say that the complaint asserts only holder claims, and for that reason, plaintiff says, the in connection with requirement is not met. SSB has two responses. I'd like to focus, if I may, concisely on the first response, which is covered, I think, at some length in the briefs, and then discuss the second response. The broader response is this. The in connection with requirement is met for an alleged misrepresentation by a broker-dealer to a customer concerning the customer's brokerage accounts. That's especially true here, where the alleged purpose of the misrepresentation was to induce the purchase of securities. A representation like that without more satisfies the in connection with requirement. That has been the consistent position of the SEC, and we respectfully submit that it's correct. Now, here's the narrower response. Plaintiff has not even succeeded in framing a bona fide holder's action. Thus, whether or not SSB's broader argument is accepted, SLUSA preempts this action. Let me explain that. The complaint does not allege any beginning date or any end date for the proposed class period. The complaint also does not allege that all putative class members purchased their securities before any alleged misrepresentations by SSB commenced. That is a key missing allegation. If a class member bought securities after the misrepresentations commenced, then the holding claim is necessarily a purchase claim. In that event, the injury would have been sustained at the time of purchase. And plaintiff actually concedes this point. In his belated 28J letter to this court of March 28, plaintiff writes, quote, Disher seeks recovery on behalf of a class who already held any stock at issue at the time SSB began misrating stocks. And then again later, nor does he seek recovery for anyone who became a holder after SSB's misratings started. Plaintiff in that letter provides no citation to the complaint, and there's a reason for that. That limitation is not in the class definition in the complaint, and as I will explain further in a moment, that is where the limitation has to appear. The putative class also does not exclude SSB customers who sold their stocks during the class period, or indeed who sold them subsequently. We, in fact, submitted undisputed proof to the district court that Disher, the representative plaintiff, sold certain of his internet and telecom stocks during the class period. But if a class member sells shares, the class member necessarily realizes any remaining losses on those shares at the time of the sale, and the class member has a sale claim, not a holder claim. Here, a properly defined holder class at a minimum would require that class members have owned the relevant securities before SSB commenced the relevant misrepresentations, which the complaint says began no later than March 2000, and would require that class members continue to hold the securities. Now, there is, as I said earlier, a general disavowal in conclusory terms in the complaint of purchase and sale claims. That's at paragraph 41. But that is not enough. The class and the claims must actually be defined in such a way as to exclude claims based on purchases or sales. The Second Circuit so held in Dabbitt. The district court so indicated in the Gordon case decided by the Northern District of Illinois, and the Southern District of New York so decided in the Atenzio case, which we submitted on our own 20HA letter. And as Dabbitt also held, if a complaint contains a mixture of holder and preempted non-holder claims, the complaint must be dismissed. Now, after all, the point of the unusual removal mechanism of SLUSA was to effectuate Congress's determination that the federal district court make the decision respecting preemption. Plaintiffs shouldn't be allowed to circumvent that intent by filing a vague complaint arguing to the federal court that SLUSA doesn't apply based on that vagueness, and then leaving the defendant back in state court where it's unclear how the state court will define and separate holder claims and non-holder claims. That's the job of the district court, even on the assumption that that distinction matters for SLUSA. As I said earlier, our broader submission is that it does not matter, and that SLUSA preempts, for the reasons the SEC has stated and as the reasons are indicated in our brief, holder and non-holder claims alike. Let me pass, then to the question, to the diversity federal question and related to bankruptcy jurisdiction questions. At the outset, there's a question as to this court's appellate jurisdiction. The court has appellate jurisdiction over the entirety of the order entered by the district court. Kircher provides for appellate jurisdiction, and once that appellate jurisdiction exists, it makes no sense for this court to parse some issues but disregard others. This isn't, we submit, a case in which the framework of pendant appellate jurisdiction is even relevant, because that concerns a situation where a district court enters an appealable order and a separate order that is non-appealable. The doctrine asks whether the two are so closely related that both come up. Here, however, we've got one order, a unitary decision, remand, and this court has jurisdiction to decide all of the issues necessarily considered by the district court. On the diversity jurisdiction point, plaintiffs have requested on their claim for unjust enrichment, disgorgement of all of SSB's profits from its investment banking relationships with internet and telecom issuers that were covered by SSB research analysts. That request falls within the common fund exception to the non-aggregation rule. That is so because plaintiff is asserting a unitary and collective alleged right of the class, not an aggregation of individual claims. On a disgorgement claim, it wouldn't matter to the amount of the recovery whether we had 10 plaintiffs or 10,000 or 10 million. It's a request for disgorgement of this unitary sum, the profits on the investment banking business, which would then be distributed over the class members. That is a single and collective right within the meaning of the case law interpreting the jurisdictional amount for purposes of diversity jurisdiction. And there is no question here that the parties are of diverse citizenship. The jurisdictional amount is all that is at issue. There is also federal question jurisdiction here by reason of count one of the complaint, which is a contractual claim resting exclusively on alleged violation of NASD and New York Stock Exchange rules. Those are federal laws for purposes of federal question jurisdiction, and that essential federal ingredient in plaintiff's claims creates federal question jurisdiction. That is the holding of Franchise Tax Board. That is also the holding of City of Chicago. We recognize that this court's Seinfeld decision, in the context of a federal statutory claim, said that an element of a state law claim based on a federal statute may not create federal jurisdiction if Congress elected not to create a federal private right of action directly based in the statute. We submit that doesn't apply here for two reasons. First, Seinfeld relied on the affirmative intent of Congress not to create a private right of action. Here, we have New York Stock Exchange and NASD rules as to which there's no intent of Congress either way. And to the extent that Seinfeld can be read more broadly, we respectfully submit that it is inconsistent with the Supreme Court's subsequent decision in City of Chicago, which, in the context of constitutional claims, emphatically reaffirmed the Franchise Tax Board holding of the Supreme Court. Your Honor?
Well, those are the general franchise tax sets forth the general principles. But have we or any of the other circuits spoken on in a more analogous situation to the one you've got here, where you're asking us to deal with the rules of the stock exchange, in effect, and to say that this is the federal issue?
Excuse me. Yes, Your Honor. There's the D'Alessio case in the Second Circuit, which is the case we principally rely upon in this area, which indicates that the rules are creatures of federal law and do give rise to questions of federal law for purposes of federal jurisdiction. Plaintiff relies on the Barbara case, which, however, concerned the internal disciplinary rules of the exchange, and we believe is very different. Court has no further questions. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ryman. We'll hear now from Mr. King.
May it please the court. I'm Robert King. One of the things that Smith Barney has argued in its reply brief and has not been mentioned here this morning, and in fact has not really been argued in this courtroom in any case yet, is the issue of the court's appellate jurisdiction over a SLUSA remand order. Now, that issue has been decided, obviously, by the Kircher panel, and that decision was circulated to all of the active members of this court before it was issued, which may cause you to wonder why in the world would I be raising it with you again. And the reason is this. I was the attorney who was involved in the remand briefing in the district court in the Kircher cases. I was not involved at all at the time. In fact, I didn't even know there had been a show cause order issued in the case, why the case should be dismissed for lack of appellate jurisdiction. The court issued that order on its own, and it was briefed, but it was not argued. The opinion was circulated to all of the active members and then issued. When I read it for the first time, I thought it was right. There's no reason that anyone on the court any member of the court who read the opinion would have any reason to question the accuracy of that opinion. I thought it was right. I thought that we had overlooked something in the statute, and that Judge Easterbrook had pointed that out to us, and that there really was appellate jurisdiction. But if you go back, as I did, because I then had to prepare the brief on the merits, and you look at the statute, which is not quoted in that opinion, there is critical language in the statute which makes it impossible to reconcile the opinion with the language of the statute, and there are three circuits which have since held there isn't appellate jurisdiction over SLUSA remand orders. The Rowinsky decision, as I pointed out in my Rule 28J letter to the court, also suggests that that might be the result, although they don't decide the issue. They reserve that issue in a footnote. They suggest that that may be the case as well. So there are three, potentially four circuits with which the Kircher decision conflicts. Here's the language in SLUSA, in the removal provision, which makes Kircher wrong. SLUSA provides that any covered class action brought in any state court involving a covered security as set forth in paragraph B shall be removable. What Judge Easterbrook overlooked in his opinion was the language as set forth in paragraph B. What Judge Easterbrook said in his decision in Kircher was that any covered class action could be removed if it involved a covered security. Now, there was no question there were covered securities involved in that case, and it was also a covered class action because it involved more than 50 investors. That's all there is to it. But that's not what makes the case removable in and of itself. There has to be more. And that's provided for in the language that says, as set forth in paragraph B. Paragraph B, in turn, provides that no covered class action based upon the statutory or common law of any state or subdivision thereof may be maintained in any state or federal court by any private party alleging, one, and this is the language that we're focused on today, an untrue statement or omission of a material fact in connection with the purchase or sale of a covered security. The import of that language and the as set forth in paragraph B language of the removal provision means, as every court which has ever addressed the issue, many, many district court opinions which we've cited in our brief, and also the other circuits that have addressed the issue, what that means is only preempted cases are removable. That's what those district judges held in those cases. That's a consolidated appeal now. Those opinions appear in the record in this case at SA 127 to 190. If you look at those, every single one of the district judges understood that only preempted cases are removable. Now, how does that bear on this court's jurisdiction? Because the district court remanded the case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, this court can't review its decision. It's barred by 28 U.S.C. 1447D, which bars appellate review of remands for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. In this case, Judge Murphy, in his written opinion the day after argument, said that the case was properly removed. But as I've explained in the brief, if you look carefully at what he did in the cases, because he was the district judge on some of the cases in Kircher, what he did there was very clear. He didn't think those cases were properly removed, and he explicitly said that they weren't. So did the other district judge, the district judge in the Kircher v. Putnam case. He said the same thing, although the Kircher opinion says that the district court had found that the removal was proper. That's incorrect, and those decisions are here in our record. In this case, Judge Murphy said the removal was proper, but then he said that he lacked subject matter jurisdiction, and he remanded the case. What he did, if you read the transcript of the argument the day before, at the very end of the argument, when Judge Murphy announced that he was going to remand the case, Smith Barney asked for a stay of his remand order pending this appeal. And what Judge Murphy did was he said, look, I'm going to go back and read Kircher and find out if I can do that. I don't think I can do that, but let me read Kircher. I'll issue an order tomorrow, and I'll let you know what I think about your motion for a stay. When he came back the next day with his written order, where he said that the removal was proper, the language tracks the Kircher opinion, where Judge Easterbrook had written that the removal in the Kircher case was proper and that the district court had so held. The district court didn't actually hold that in the Kircher case, and Judge Murphy clearly did it here only because he had gone back and read Kircher, and following this court's authority, he did what he understood Kircher to require him to do, which is to find that the removal is proper and then decide whether or not to remand or dismiss the case. So there's no question that in this case, Judge Murphy really, regardless of whether or not he thinks the removal was proper, he clearly did not believe that he had subject matter jurisdiction over the case. He says it explicitly in the transcript the day before, and he remanded for that reason. And I would submit to the court that the court ought to take another look at that issue, and that the issue ought to be decided as it has been decided in the other three circuits that have expressly held that SLUSA remand orders are not reviewable, and that that should be circulated under Rule 40E to the active members of this court, and Kircher should be overruled, and this appeal should be dismissed. Now, I recognize that that's an extraordinary relief that I'm requesting, given the recent vintage of the Kircher decision. I think that is the correct and only appropriate result, but if the court, for whatever reason, decides that it wants to go further, I think the next thing that we have to talk about then is whether or not there's any appellate jurisdiction over the remaining issues here. Kircher did not say, and in fact none of the defendants in Kircher raised any of the other issues which they had raised in the district court as bases for removing those cases. That was not discussed in Kircher at all. Kircher does not hold that every issue comes up on appeal just because the SLUSA ruling can be appealed. In this case, what we have is the defendant trying to bootstrap on the Kircher decision and raise all of these other issues, which unquestionably could not be raised in this court but for the SLUSA remand. There would be no appeal. We wouldn't be here today to discuss those other issues. And the only authority that Smith Barney has offered for your reviewing those other remand rulings on federal question jurisdiction and diversity jurisdiction is an analogy to a statute. A statute, Section 1292B, which, when a district court certifies an issue for interlocutory appeal, makes the entire order, by the language of the statute, makes the entire order appealable. We don't have that statute at play here. We don't have any statute at play here. We don't have any authority. They have not cited a single case from anywhere suggesting that you do have the authority to go to those other issues. I was the one who raised the issue of pendent appellate jurisdiction because I can't conceive of any other basis for this court to look at those issues than possibly pendent appellate jurisdiction. And for the reasons I've explained in the brief, which is that pendent appellate jurisdiction requires the court to look at issues which couldn't otherwise be raised if it's necessary to give meaningful review to an issue which could be raised. But Smith Barney itself, in its brief at page 6 of its brief, has said it raised 4 independent grounds for removal. So this court can look at the SLUSA issue if it chooses not to review the Kircher decision or revisit the Kircher decision. It can review that issue without reaching the other issues, which are indisputably not appealable and not appropriate for appellate review, which would then leave only, and the only issue that I really plan to address in any greater depth, is the SLUSA removal. In this case, if you look at the complaint, and I was involved in the drafting of this complaint, so I know what we intended, and the district judge certainly understood that we intended to include only holders. Now, counsel has indicated, and in preparing for this appeal, I realized that we could have, if we had inserted one or perhaps two words in the complaint, made it absolutely crystal clear that we're not trying to include any claims or people of the sort that Smith Barney is talking about. We don't seek to represent, this plaintiff doesn't seek to represent anyone who purchased after Smith Barney began secretly abandoned its three-point rating system. We don't seek to represent those folks. We only seek to represent people who already held stock at that time. And we don't seek to represent them with respect to any other purchases they might have made after that time. Only those people who already held stock and only with respect to their claims of the stock that they held at that time. Those are the only folks that we seek to represent. If you take a look at our complaint, that's what we were trying to do in paragraphs 39 and then 41, where we explicitly disavow any claims based upon Smith Barney's conduct in connection with plaintiffs or any class members' purchases or sales of any of the internet stocks or telecom stocks. Now, in paragraph 39, what we could have done and should have done and would have eliminated this issue, and we will do if given the opportunity to amend our complaint, is in paragraph 39, we should have said that we bring this class action on behalf of all customers of Smith Barney who already held. We said who held one or more of the internet stocks. We should have said who already held. And that would eliminate this issue. But there can be no question that the district court clearly understood that we don't represent, that we have not sought to represent anyone other than holders, and that this is truly a purely holders case. What that means is that there is no purchase or sale involved in the case. There is no purchase or sale. Plaintiff hasn't brought a case on behalf of any seeking recovery for any loss associated with a purchase in the case, and sales don't matter. It is true, or it certainly appears to be true from the record, that the plaintiff sold some of the stocks at issue after Smith Barney began to misrate the stocks and had secretly abandoned its five-point rating system. But those are sales. Those aren't sales in connection with Smith Barney's ratings of those stocks as sell, buy, outperform, or neutral. They're in spite of those ratings. He sold despite the fact that Smith Barney was saying buy. Those are not sales that are in connection with Smith Barney's misconduct. They're in spite of Smith Barney's misconduct. And the sales aren't in the case because we've simply excluded those claims from the case. As a result of that, there is no SLUSA preemption here. There is no in connection with a purchase or sale. You can interpret in connection with just about as broadly as you want, as Smith Barney has advocated, as the Supreme Court admittedly has in Zanford. But that doesn't provide the sale, the purchase or sale requirement of the statute, which is expressly required by SLUSA. It tracks the language of Section 10B. In their brief, in their opening brief, they have a section which I think simply defies the statutes, the language of the statute, and I think that it exposes what their real point is here, which is there doesn't have to be any purchase or sale, and that is expressly required by the statute. And we'll stand on our brief with respect to the remaining points. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. King.
Very briefly, Your Honors.
First, on whether this panel should reconsider the jurisdictional ruling in Kircher. The Kircher panel at the time it decided the jurisdictional point was well aware of two of the decisions in the other circuits to which counsel for plaintiff alluded. It considered and rejected the reasoning in those cases. In Kircher itself, the jurisdictional issue was again briefed after being decided by a motions panel before on the merits. Their plaintiff made all of the arguments that you've heard today respecting the overruling of Kircher. Judge Easterbrook and Judge Wood were, I think it's fair to say, at least based on the oral argument, seemed not to be not to be inclined to retreat from the jurisdictional decision that had been entered earlier in that case. We respectfully submit that this court should follow Kircher, a well-reasoned and fully informed and recent decision of the circuit, circulated, as counsel acknowledged, pursuant to Rule 40E. As for the decision below, Judge Murphy indeed indicated in the order that the case had been properly removed pursuant to Kircher. The suggestion was made that that should somehow be disregarded because he was acting on behalf of, by compulsion under Kircher, but that's what district judges do. They follow the law of the circuit. There were some comments made on the transcript prior to entry of the order and prior to Judge Murphy's review of Kircher, but what governs is the order. He appropriately followed the Kircher decision. On the appellate jurisdiction point, both the final decision rule, which authorizes appeals to this court, and the general bar on review of certain remand orders in Section 1447 speak in terms of orders and decisions. Section 1447 doesn't say that where a remand order is appealable, the Court of Appeals may not consider issues decided by the district court that, had they formed the exclusive basis for the remand order, would not have resulted in an appealable order. There's not a reason in the world to construe it that way. The universally acknowledged purpose of the prohibition in Section 1447, limited as it is to prevent delay, to make sure that when a remand order falls within the compass of the statute, the case goes back to state court promptly and proceedings then follow. But we're already here. There is no incremental delay that will attach if this court considers all of the issues decided by the district court, and we respectfully submit that that is what it should do. I refer to the court, I see my time has expired, to the Atenzio case in particular for its discussion of the appropriate class definition and the insufficiency of a general disavowal. On the sales point, the arguments that counsel is now making about what constitutes the disavowal of a sales-based claim and the disagreement that has emerged between the two of us here today are precisely the reason that the complaint should make clear what their class definition is.
I think we have the point. Thank you, Mr. Riemann.
Thank you very much.
Indeed, our thanks to both counsel for very